Welcome to the New World Empire. Sounds funny saying it that way. Is anyone really welcome in the New World Empire? Besides the Whitebirds, of course. Now, one thing right away that you'll want to understand is that sometimes when we say Whitebirds, we're referring to a kind of vehicle, a kind of airplane, if you will, or hovercraft. Looks like a white dragonfly. Large enough for a nice-sized living room, piloting area, restroom, and a kitchen. And other times, when we say white bird, we're referring to the people who own them. There are only 30 white birds in existence. As you might imagine, the people who own the white birds are very powerful people indeed. It was King Wagalseed, in the 29th year of his rule, who, together with the greatest minds and innovators of his age, designed, produced, and combined their talents to make the 30 Whitebirds, each of which were guaranteed to fly anywhere you'd care to go, up to 4 centuries without maintenance. Fusion was how it was done. You could fly shockingly close to the sun, out to the edges of the solar system and beyond if you'd care to spend your entire life between stars. Or to the depths of the ocean. In Wagalseed's 87th year, before they had been revealed to the world, they were hidden away, guarded by the royal house of Anglesey's most trusted Redbirds. Now, as you might have guessed, Redbirds sometimes refers to a class of people, other times to the kind of car they drive. Many of you come from a world like theirs. If you've ever called someone a Mercedes or a Honda, you know what I mean. The Redbirds were smaller, but large enough for a mattress and a shower. Every 3 days, they had to land at an appointed location called a gas station. And only a handful of the world's historians at that time would have been able to explain why that was what they were called. The year was 2463, according to the old Gregorian calendar. Unbeknownst to Wagalseed, the first and, thank God, the only of his name, he had a cousin named Teliard. Saint Teliard, as he would later become known, as it might be in the universe where you're from. It's the winners who decide who gets to be called saints. But I'm getting ahead of myself. And so, that's where we are now, and that's where we shall begin. Teliard the Third stepped down from the royal blimp of Anglesey onto the icy ground of a small island in the Faroes. The clouds had parted briefly, and the sun shone down on the snow, reflecting blinding white light back up into the sky. Teliard's eyes were sharp and green under graying eyebrows, and his skin was beardless and wrinkled with 75 Earth years age. As he stepped onto the ice, he covered his eyes with protective glasses, which, like much of his suit, reflected every color of the spectrum. His suit was white and iridescent, of high noble class, and his left breast bore the small blue shield and the red and white cross on the cross, the family crest of the ancient House of Anglesey. His graying red hair was shoulder-length and blew wildly behind him as the wind was in his face. As he walked down the hill toward a stone wall, he brushed a bit of hair away from his eyes with the back of his left hand, knowing that those who watched him would recognize his sign to them, and they would know that the hour was at hand. He walked sideways down a deep slope as the snow slid out from under him and he found his footing on the man-made steps. Upon reaching the stone wall, he lifted a small white plastic remote control with a single button, which controlled many doors. Recognizing his thumbprint, the remote activated the gate disguised as a stone, and it opened outward toward him. Inside, 50 redbirds, standing in two rows, facing inward, awaiting his arrival, as 10 more hurriedly finished their tasks and rushed to join them in line. These were the executives and the aristocrats who alone volunteered to protect and serve their empire in the mass self-discipline, or Global International Guard. Each of them flew a personal hovercraft shaped like a large red dragonfly. Though each of these hovercrafts for which they are named, the Redbirds, seated two, they each alone would pilot them. While they recognized that they had many superiors and that there were many nobles of a higher status than themselves, many were not aware of the names or the faces of the actual kings and queens of the Round Table, nor of the family ties which bound the royal families with their immediate and most trusted servants. Teliard walked slowly into the hollowed-out hill and pressed the button once again once he was inside, and the rocks slid back into place behind him. Halogen lights from above lit the space. About him were chairs and tables supporting computer terminals littered with sodas and snack wrappers, which betrayed that the Reds were not expecting a noble to visit them this day. They did not dare ask questions of him, but awaited orders. Once the rocks were closed, one of them removed his helmet, prompting all of the others to do the same, and they held them in their left arms across their chest, with their right arms at their sides. Teliard walked between them, looking each in the eyes as they each kept their gaze directly in front of them. After he had reached the end of the line, he gazed forward at the jewels this place protected, in such a hermetic secrecy that only these 60 men and the royal house of Anglesey knew of their existence. 30 white birds waited majestically for their purpose. These were the only hovercrafts of their kind. Each of these could move more swiftly by far than any red bird on the planet. These were the prototypes which would be the models for a future generation of Redbirds once Anglesey had finished gaining further dominance of the Round Table, using this advantage against the other 12 royal houses. Each of the Whitebirds were identical. Like the Redbirds, their form closely resembled that of a dragonfly, due to a fascination of an inventor and designer long before forgotten. Each of the Whitebirds were new, flawless, and reflected their surroundings like a white sheet of curved glass. Each of them bore on the nose the family crest of the House of Anglesey. Each of them were powered by fusion and would move silently through the depths of the ocean or through outer space. And each of these had maroon leather interior. Teliard turned around to face the two lines of Redbirds. When he spoke, his accent betrayed a mixed background, having spent little time fixed in one single location. His voice was that of command, sharp and direct. "As you were, gentlemen." The Reds slouched their shoulders a bit and turned to face him, moving out of the lineup so that each could see him. The leader in the back, the one who had first removed his helmet, was the first to speak. "I trust you had a pleasant journey, sir?" Teliard sighed. "Regretfully, there is no time for pleasantries. The white birds must be moved to another location. Quickly! We are on a tight schedule." Teliard turned once again to face the white birds as the Reds rushed to them, opened the doors, stepped up to them. They each lifted half a meter from the ground, making only the subtlest warbling hum, and four lights turned on each of them. Two in the nose, two on the wings, pointing forward. As the Redbirds returned to their original lineup, Teliard turned and slowly walked back to the false stone gate. Upon reaching the gate, he turned to face them, and he pushed the small button with his left hand over his right shoulder and waited as the stones slid apart. The Reds stared at one another, 30 on one side, 30 on the other, awaiting further instructions. When the stones were finished opening, Teliard shouted a single word. "Now!" After a few seconds, every one of them fell to the ground simultaneously, with small, furry blue darts in each of their necks. 29 men and women filed in behind him, gathering in a crowd about him. Each of these men and women wore bulletproof rebels' uniforms. They were blue uniforms, with black elbow, shoulder, and knee pads, and black shoes. Each of them wore a black belt with a red-handled sword in a black sheath on their left side. Some of them had the faces of men and women from southern places, others from the Far East, Hebrarabia. Others had the pale complexion of Europeans, and some were from the very subways of New World Center. Each of them stood silently alongside Teliard III, staring at the 30 white birds beyond the two lines of unconscious red birds. Teliard turned and looked at them one by one, and they each returned his gaze. Each wore a smile which betrayed an awareness of this moment in history unfolding through them and about them, the import of what they were about to do. Teliard smiled wide, nodding. The time has come. To Venus! The 30 of them ran forward between and around the reds, and each chose one of the white birds, climbed inside and closed the hatch behind them. Teliard's bird led them out the stone gate. After the last of them had exited, the gate closed, and they were gathered in a triangular formation just above the island. Teliard's bird disappeared, leaving a brief flame in its wake, and the other 29 burst forth immediately afterward, making a cracking sound, which no one conscious was close enough to hear.
Many gray-skinned, half-human, half-reticulans were gathered where Teliard and his men set down the white birds. They landed at the planned location, opened their hatches, removed their helmets, and stepped down to the surface of Venus. A crowd of slender, tall hominids with only a few recognizable human features were there staring at them curiously. They had black eyes and pale gray skin, very little hair, and long, bony arms and fingers. They moved cautiously and slowly. Teller III was the first to speak.
"We are humans."
"You are our ancestors," one of the Minutians spoke. Teliard III's heart skipped a beat.
"You speak English?"
Another Venusian replied.
"Yes, we can hear your language in our minds."
One of the blue uniformed rebels stepped forward and placed a hand on Teliard's shoulder.
"May I?"
"Of course, Job." Teliard motioned with his hand toward the Venusians. Job walked up to one of the Venusians and handed him the small cube. He said, "This contains the history of our people, millennia of accumulated technology and ideas, and the means to communicate with any of us who are not a part of what we call the Empire." The Venusian closed his fingers around the small black cube and looked back at Job and said, "We have been waiting for you." Job bowed his head.
Several hundred redbirds appeared rapidly in the sky above them. Aflame with the heat of friction, a clap of thunder shook the area. The rebels and Teliard scattered as beams of white-hot light shot down from the redbirds, killing most of the humans. 30 reds lowered down on ropes near the whitebirds, which they then reclaimed. The 30 whitebirds and several hundred reds left Venus in a hurry, leaving one white-clad and 26 blue-uniformed corpses scattered around them. Many Venusians looked up, and many looked at the bodies. One looked at the cube in his hand, turned, and walked away. Soon, the others followed.
Teliard and the rebels knew that the redbirds would come. They knew
it was a one-way trip. The Empire, which is to say the House of Anglesey, that round table throne in charge of Great Britain and her colonies, reclaimed the 30 Whitebirds. Over the years which followed, Wagalsi disseminated them to his allies around the table, to those whose economic interest benefited him. This psychologically established a hierarchy where none had yet been firmly established. They all kind of knew who was in charge, but this really made the pecking order clear for everybody. The only kings to receive 3 Whitebirds were Gabe Romanov of Greater Russia and Shlomo Ben Saud of Hebrarabia. They each received 3. Greg de Medici, as well as Carlos Habsburg of South America, Jimmy Vanderbilt of North America, John Kahn, and Ren Tokugawa, received 2 Whitebirds each. Lar Rothschild and Shu Gioro each received 1 Whitebird. Luzi of Han, Liwo Dayar, and Afonso Diogo received none. By 2531, some 60 years later, Charles the Grey was born. He was born right in the heart of the former Ishtar Terra Carnivorous Dome, and as he grew up, he would often climb Maxwell Montes for sport. Once, while climbing, he lost his footing. The gravel gave way, and, much to his surprise, an unbroken coffee cup was revealed. He cleaned it and kept it, studied it, and determined that, while it seemed impossible to his knowledge of history, it would have been left there over 200 years prior. The only sentient beings of any kind back then were 2 clones of Samuel Fathom, who were in charge of the terraforming project. As Charles grew, he came to discover that he had actually been named after a story that was passed down from, one could say, father to son, from older Fathom to younger Fathom, about a boy named Charles, who had walked in from an interdimensional coffee house, he claimed, slid down the mountain, and was cared for by the Fathoms, who then conveniently sent him back through the door. There was no evidence of this, but Venus's famous Fathom's numerals were said to have been given to young Joseph by this young man from another universe whose name was Charles. It was perhaps this that made Charles so unusual as a Venusian. Being isolated is a different sort of thing when your entire race is telepathic. He hid nothing from his fellow Venusians, yet they all kept their distance. He was by far more interested in Earth and in humans than any other Venusian. One day he met Job, who had survived the Redbird attack in 2463. Job was 112 years old. Charles the Grey found him in a cave. His fingernails had grown long, his skin stretched across his skull, his hair gray and thin. He looked up at Charles in his real form. Physically, he was half gray alien, half human. And he said, "I have been waiting for you." Now, one might wonder what Job had been doing there all of that time. Job was very active in the free web, in a place called Underground America, where he took on a role known as the Lincoln. Now, there were many people who took on the role of the Lincoln. Perhaps I should back up a little bit to provide some context for this. Now, you who are listening to this might come from a universe where there was a gentleman named Guy Fawkes, who was very upset at the Church of England for having separated from the Catholic Church and tried to start a fire. Long story short, in the universe we're talking about, he never had an issue and was a man of very little note because there was no Church of England. For that matter, there was no parliament for him to blow up. Fast forward 200 years to about 1860s, about 30 years after a papal decree had made slavery illegal throughout the world, there was a man named Abraham Lincoln who, together with his sons, had barricaded themselves in a fort, stolen guns, and insisted that people should have the right to opt out of confession and not to be shunned by society upon excommunication. This mission was, of course, hopeless, and he was killed on behalf of the Vanderbilt Empire by one Robert E. Lee. A couple hundred years later, in the early 21st century, when the free web was first established, there was a time that they would speak openly through video channels and even in public occasionally. They would cover their tracks digitally, redirect their IPs to other countries, and each of them would wear a mask of Abraham Lincoln. They called themselves the Lincolns. The technology of the world empire allowed for a secondary civilization, which operated parallel to the mainstream of civilization, which was under the tight scrutiny of those who claimed to have been elected into positions of power by the people they were ruling. And the people, for the most part, actually believed this or doubted it and felt they were powerless to do anything about it. Perhaps the most productive use of time and energy of the resistance at that time was the advent of the Black Web, as it was known to the Empire. It was known to freemen as the Free Web. This operated on the same principle as what was called the Internet at the time, but was based primarily on short-range, densely compacted radio waves, focused like lasers. Over the decades which followed, it evolved into the multifaceted digital four-dimensional neural sensory interactive projection right alongside the Internet. If these Lincolns, if these heroes of old, had not put so much energy into the free web, which the Empire referred to as the Black Web, then there would have been little to no hope for the resistance or for the human race centuries later, and there certainly wouldn't have been anything for Teliard and the rebels to give the Venusians that day. As it is written on the wall on the inside of Palace One of New Ancient Land, in the machine the paradise is fluid and deceptive, trance-like and expensive, and nothing is left to protest its total control over your neural net. Meanwhile, back on Earth, in a place which geographically you would know as Manhattan, which was known as New World Center in their universe, in the subways, there lived several hundred rebels. These subways remained in the older style, and there were a lot more of them, and then eventually they were completely abandoned, and so they make a perfect hiding place for rebels to live right underneath a metropolis. Johnny and Joanne were two such rebels. They had a son and a daughter. Blythe was born in 2627 Gregorian. Baggett was born in 2636. In 2640, when Blythe was 13 and Baggett was 4, the Redbirds raided the station they were hiding in. Blythe's father led a group of men up to the surface, all of whom were killed. Blythe and her mother stayed behind. The Redbirds eventually came down and shot Blythe's mother. In the 2640th year of the Gregorian calendar. Eyes were open the moment you were born. I swear it to you, I was there. Blythe's mother, Joanne, spoke as she lay bleeding to death on the asphalt underground beneath New World Center. Joanne was fearless. She wore the uniform they all wore, blue and black. Mom, was all the then 13-year-old Blythe could manage to say through the tears. Your eyes were open, and you were breathing. You looked the nurse in the eye, and then you glanced down at the umbilical cord to remind her. She was just staring in awe of what had just come into this world. Blythe squeezed her mother's hand. It's not true, Mama. You're making it all up, she said, as she turned to the direction of the sound of many redbirds running. Blythe saw another girl her own age, standing where the redbirds had come in from before, staring back at her.
"I swear it to you,"
Joanne insisted. Blythe turned back to her mother. She resented the girl for being there, for taking away any attention from her mother at this moment. She looked strange. Her hair was black, and she wore a red dress that was far too nice, even for an aristocrat's daughter. The girl was not more than 2 meters away. She was grinning.
"In a moment like this? You're not going anywhere,"
Blythe insisted. "Take care of your brother," was the last thing her mother said.
"I want you to stay here if anything happens, Blythe. We'll need someone watching to tell us where they are."
"You could have one of the drones do it for you. I doubt anyone would notice. The manager gods are a little slow these days, I hear. That way, I can be out there saving your ass from the redbirds the next time you slip on shit."
"Are you ever going to let me live that down? That was once. And the next time you space out and start tripping out on the meaning of a hamburger, who's going to be there to carry the blade that comes down in your neck?"
"You know what? Shut up, Simon. We need allies in their world. Spies."
"How do you propose we accomplish this?"
"I don't know, but I'd be willing to bet they have some in our world."
"If they were down here, then they'd know where we are, and we wouldn't be able to hide from them."
"The same stuff that you're looking at, Simon, is all the information they have access to."
"You think that they have spies down here with blue uniforms and rebel swords?"
"And I didn't say I thought there might. I said I would be willing to bet."
"Then they'd have some kind of communication with the Redbirds."
"Do you honestly think that the Empire is as simple as Redbirds and invisible kings?"
"Tell the others, Blythe. Just stay here. Get your little brother."
"Fuck you, fuck off! There isn't any time for you willing to fight. Come to the surface."
"Wait for the others, Blythe! Damn you!"
"What should I do?" Blythe asked as they gazed out beyond the edge of her checkerboard porch at the mathematically generated ocean which seemed about 100 meters below them, heard the seagulls, and felt the mist envelop them. She had seen 5 of the palaces, and opted to return to her body in the subways, as it was now fully regenerated from 10 years of atrophy. First, though, she had asked Charles for a few minutes of his time, and had discovered this pre-setting after fidgeting around with her new controls for a few minutes, along with 2 comfortable chairs hovering at just the right height. "To be honest, Blythe, I don't know. Every organ in the body has its own function, and if no one fights them, they will only grow and will hunt down the free. Yet I believe freedom is in the way of nonviolence. Every flower, every tree, every grain of sand has its role, its place and destiny to fulfill. And I remind myself to live in my life in a constant state of oneness with my own present footsteps, while seeking to better understand and clarify a direction in order to fulfill my own destiny. There's no way I can tell you what your destiny is, or is not. Should doesn't even come into this. I would tell you what I would do in your place, which would be to not fight them, and to build a life far away from them. Or I could tell you what I think you want to hear, which would be to fight. So it really doesn't work very well either way. I can tell you that my motive for doing what I do in the UA grid is indeed partly to give ex-drones a place to build a world and forget about their anger, so that the pain and bloodshed be not perpetuated any further at all. This is what drives me, what speaks truth to the core of my soul. And yet, your place may very well be ordained by you and the vast together that you lead the very movement I seek to oppose in my own way. Yet, I am here to serve you. Do what you will with what you have and what I have, and I will support you in your decision, whatever it may be. I just won't be doing these things myself, that's all." "Thank you," Blythe said, nodding slowly, taking his human-form hand into her own. "Of course, Blythe. Just don't force anyone else to fight against their will.
nor manipulate those of weaker foundation. I will never support that. And please, please, don't get yourself killed.
Corporation G7-923 stood tall and proud, somewhere toward the southern edge of New World Center. Corporation G7-923 stood tall and proud, somewhere toward the southern edge of New World Center. Invisible, Reynolds whispered into their 17th drone's ear, "The vests and belts will be picked up by a human called Bluebird Simon, then store new settings and destination and continue with the old." And he sprayed his canister into its mind and sat for a while on the simulated carpet beside the manager god. The manager god here wasn't very original. She was a very serious-looking woman with a gray skirt and jacket. She stood with her arms folded, looking out at the drones, one by one. The drones weren't so easy to recognize or distinguish as the manager god. Mainly just a collective blur of movement. Reynolds stood up, turned to face the manager god's ear, and whispered, "I am a pawn." Thinking this was her own thought, the manager god wrinkled her forehead, confused.
"Number 36, research, priority 1. What is a pawn? Report."
Reynolds walked up to number 57, whom he knew was truly Evan Ridge, a former Redbird who was being kept on ice for some reason. What Reynolds didn't know was that Evan was actually the fifth next of kin of King Mao the 42nd of Chejo Do, and an ex-lover of Lucy's. Reynolds whispered into the ear of the drone formerly called, and who would never again be called, Evan, "I'm doing this wrong. The manager god said yesterday new plans for mask and sword, blade, and handle." And sprayed his mind with the detailed program. "And she said rewrite destination, Montauk Point Harbor, Dock 12, 1600, to be picked up by a human called Bluebird Simon at 1300 hours, then store new settings and destination and continue with the old."
"A pawn is a piece of an ancient game called chess. It is of the lowest value. It may move forward one square at a time or two squares in the first move, capture other pieces only on a one-space diagonal forward move, and may be promoted to any piece other than a king upon reaching the eighth rank, or it is the person or an entity used to further the purposes of another."
Number 36 responded aloud. Reynolds looked over his shoulder at the manager god, grinning at her extremely confused facial expression. "Why would I think such a thing?" As she surveyed the drones again, her shoulders squared on the space near Reynolds and her eyes becoming very focused.
"Number 57, why did you change one of your routines? Report now."
"It just took me some time to put your orders into effect from yesterday," said the drone, terrified at having shirked his duties.
"Why did your adrenal glands just release? What are you hiding?" the manager god demanded.
I'm lying to you, my lady. The delay was my own fault. I should have made the changes sooner," he said, weeping.
The manager god pointed a small object at the drone and pushed a button, causing him a very sharp sensation of electrocution. He yelped like a dog, then instantly spent all of his accumulated credits from the previous minute and a half on a numbing sensation and some pleasant, uplifting music for his ears alone. And returned to his duties. The manager god checked his monitor and saw the blue masks being sewn and swords being forged and packaged by many robotic tentacles, which she would never fathom, were actually on the other side of a big round world. However, as Reynolds already knew, this manager god was colorblind. I forgot about the changes. I must not let the voices know I'm forgetting things, or they will terminate me, she thought to herself. Reynolds looked at the manager god's expression, sighed, whispered to himself, "Hypocrites, all of us."
Don't let it happen again, drone!
She snapped abruptly at the entity formerly known as Evan, then returned her gaze to the others, trying to forget what had just transpired. She paused for a few seconds, looking at number 17, but decided not to investigate. Reynolds chuckled a bit. Ah, so predictable. Well, there you have it, Blythe. Your new uniforms. Then Reynolds disappeared from that place.
Just tell me what needs to be done. I feel compelled to point out to you that if you exert yourself like this, you'll delay your recovery and you won't be any good to anyone. All right, Blythe said, as she threw down the screwdriver and dropped a small metal contraption onto the floor, then picked it up and replaced it on the table while wiping the sweat off her forehead. She looked over at young Baggett with a chilling focus and more than a hint of resentment. On his face, she noticed the effect of her word, action, and facial expression, so she closed her eyes for a second and reopened them, managed a hint of a smile and a brief nod before staggering into her cot. Get a pen and write this down. Tell Simon we need more fuel and more meat, and have him bring some nitric acid and baking soda and an eyedropper. Let me know when he gets here, and I'll tell you where to go from there. And would you let Charles know I got his message and tell him the injury was minor? Right away,
the young rebel said, and ran off.
And get me some aspirin.
She sealed the door and picked up a wire that was dangling beside her bed. She noted the way her face looked in the reflection of the metal tip at the end, the rhythm of her breathing and the beating of her veins. God, how I hate this shit, she said aloud, referring to her life in the old subways. Behind her hand was a blue mask with a filter built in around the mouthpiece and a small upward-pointed red sword embroidered into the forehead. What does it mean, Charles? She managed to whisper, then quickly shoved the metal plug into the back of her neck and fell into total relaxation on her bed.
She sat upright in her large blue swiveling chair behind the desk. In front of her on the wall was a map of New World Center, a perfect three-dimensional replica based on this instant satellite surveillance. Map, how many drones are there in New World Center? A synthesized voice replied,
There are 15,625,000 drones in New World Center.
She thought it was creepy when the computer sounded too human.
Map, how many rebels are there in New World Center?
Unknown.
Good, Blythe said and nodded wearily, yawning.
Map, how many drones are there in the world?
There are 27,465,010,402 drones in the world.
Blythe's eyes became focused, and she put her forehead on her desk.
And two?
Map, who was the last drone to be added to the machine?
A rebel who called himself Bluebird Simon. He was en route from somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean toward New World Center and was arrested by Sergeant Reynolds, MSD President of G6-1232 Guilford Point Metropolis, and added to the staff of G6-1232 today at 4:32 a.m. Standard Time.
Blythe checked her watch just in time to see a change from 4:34 a.m. to 4:35 a.m.
then put her hand to her mouth and rose from her desk. She walked toward the sliding glass doors which opened for her as she stepped through them. On the other side was the tiled porch, with a few modifications, including a waist-high stone railing, which she leaned on to gaze out at the sounds and smells and sights of 180 degrees of the ocean at night. She leaned her elbows on the rail, stifled the urge to vomit, and shook her head from side to side, forcing the tears not to come.
As he was coming out of the kitchen area in the back, much to his surprise, he heard Clara's voice saying, "Charles? Charles, are you here?" "I'm here, Clara. What's wrong?" He was face to face with a very, very intense version of Clara, who wore blue jeans and a blue denim jacket over a blue shirt and had fiery red hair. "Who are you? How do you know my middle name? Why are you acting like you know me? Is this some new avatar of yours I haven't seen? Do you know Charles the Grey?" she said. Charles Reuben thought about it for a minute and said, "Blythe? Okay, so you know my name now. Who are you?" "I'm Charles," he said, "but not Charles the Grey. Would you like a cup of coffee?" he said, and offered her the cup he had just made himself. She took the cup without thanking him and said, "Do you know where he is? It's very important," and took a sip. Charles, which is to say Charles Reuben, said, "Clara told me he'd be here soon." Blythe said, "That's great, but who's Clara?" Charles Reuben said, "It's complicated," and smiled at her a little too brightly. "Okay, please stop looking at me like some kind of creep," Charles said. "I'm so sorry. You look like someone I once knew. Please forgive me if it seemed inappropriate." Blythe rolled her eyes and said, "Whatever." Charles said, "So, have you already been a surrogate for Simon and all that?" Blythe said, "How do you know Simon?" Charles said, "Well, I guess we might be waiting here for a while, so do you mind if I make myself a cup?" Blythe stood and followed him and said, "Actually, let me see how you do that. That looks very interesting." Charles did his best to hide a knowing smile and began to wonder if Clara remembered everything that was unfolding before him in real time as a proto-memory of her original imprinted personality 16,000 years earlier. He grinded the beans and explained, as best he could, what he knew from Clara's story, that she, which is to say Blythe, had come to Coffee House 1 to ask Charles the Grey for help freeing Simon, and that he'd helped her, and she filled in for Simon as a drone while Charles the Grey took him through the palaces of New Ancient Land. "I've been through the first 5 palaces of New Ancient Land," Blythe said, and pointed out the window at the pink glowing palace in the distance. "That's what Palace 1 looked like as I was leaving. I wonder what it's doing here." Just then, the walls began to move. Charles Reuben looked at Blythe, who looked back, raising an eyebrow. The whole scene morphed, the windows disappeared, and they found themselves inside of the sandstone hallway. Charles Reuben said, "Oh, don't worry. It's just Charles the Grey remodeling." They walked to the end of the hallway and out onto the malachite floor. He turned around and saw that first mirrored pyramid. But today, all the portals led to darkness. And when he looked around, though there was whale song again, there were no other islands. There were a few tables scattered hither and yon, all very familiar looking. He also noticed that the pink palace was gone. Turned around and looked at the mirrored pyramid, saw that the very top was glowing. He nodded to himself, starting to understand. Hovering high above them, Blythe and Charles both saw a rectangular platform and a man in a gray suit. Behind him was another portal which led to darkness. Blythe said, "Charles!" And the gray-suited man, whose skin was also gray, stood. "Blythe?" he said.
and floated down toward them. Hovering high above them, Blythe and Charles both saw a rectangular platform and a man in a gray suit. Behind him was another portal which led to darkness. Blythe said, "Charles!" And the gray-suited man, whose skin was also gray, stood. "Blythe?" he said, and floated down toward them. Charles the Grey wore the form of Byron in his 20s, complete with the period suit. He was all shades of grey, except for his bright green eyes. He, Charles Reuben, and the 29-year-old mortal, whose name Charles Reuben now knew was Blythe Clara Elbakian, stood on a rectangle of tiles which floated near the edge of that first malachite-floored outdoor coffeehouse island, with the three-story mirrored pyramid near the edge of one of its randomized geologic shapes. Behind Charles the Grey on the rectangle was another door to blankness, like the one Charles had learned not to put his head through. The 12 doors, or at least those which he could see, on the pyramid also led to nowhere, or wherever it was. Charles Reuben extended his hand. "I'm Charles Reuben. I was named after you." Charles the Grey shook his hand slowly. "I'm Charles the Grey. I was named after you." "What?" Blythe said. Charles the Grey laughed, and Charles Reuben was amazed. Charles the Grey said, "Do you remember the fathoms?" Charles Reuben said, "Yes." Charles the Grey said, "In reality, I look like this," and snapped his fingers. Charles the Grey, as youthful Byron, was replaced in the blink of an eye by Charles's true Venusian, half-human, half-reticulan form. His eyes were all pupil, no iris or sclera, all black and larger than human. He was 7 foot tall and mostly bald, with gray skin and out-of-place seeming brown hair in all of the appropriate places. He was naked and clearly male and evidently not Jewish. "Wow," Blythe and Charles said simultaneously. Charles the Grey snapped again and returned to his favorite avatar form. He said, "Venusians usually take on human forms when we interact in the free web." Blythe and Charles Reuben both started talking at once, being courteous, not to mention now hopelessly in love with the 16,000-year-old exodimensional barista simulacrum of Blythe at exactly this point in her life. Charles deferred. Blythe said, "Simon Schwartz has been arrested and is now a drone. I can't free him without your help. Can you do for him what you did for me?" Charles the Grey became very introspective and thoughtful. He put his hand to his chin, made like as if he were about to speak, and then sighed, thinking. Charles Reuben timidly interjected, raising a finger. "If I may?" Blythe remembered how Charles was muttering over the coffee grinder earlier that he knew something about Simon being arrested and how to get him out. Charles the Grey said, "Yes?" Charles Reuben said, "It's just that I might be able to save you some time, which is, of course, important because of the living hell Simon is in right now. Every moment counts." Charles the Grey and Blythe were now both intensely interested, and Blythe said, "Go on." Charles Reuben said, "Clara told me that Charles couldn't get the consent of the other Lincolns." "The other Lincolns?" Blythe said, turning to Charles the Grey, who looked embarrassed. "Were you my Lincoln on that first day?" she said. Charles the Grey laughed, and she hit him, and said, "Now, first, can you explain Clara to me again? She looks just like me, but she's a fucking computer. God, I'm gonna be sick." Charles Reuben continued, "It's because of this. It'll make sense in a minute." So, Charles Reuben explained that because immediately after Charles the Grey freed Blythe, Blythe started blowing things up, the Lincolns are going to hesitate to offer their help to Charles the Grey again. Then Charles will suggest taking Simon through the first three palaces of New Ancient Land, while you stand in
as Simon's surrogate. While I stand in, Blythe said, that'll take forever. Charles the Grey said, let's do it, Blythe. As he said, everything he said checks out, and every minute counts. We don't want him to be too far gone by the time we make the switch. Blythe nodded, and they both looked back at Charles Reuben. Blythe said, you were going to say something earlier, though. Charles tried not to stare at Blythe. She was identical to Clara in every way, except for her hair. Blythe's hair was flaming red and wavy and chaotic. Clara's was straight and brown and even. Blythe's face was red with blood, full of anger, ambition, some Martian force. Clara's face betrayed thousands of years of meditation, contemplation, and leading some multiversal Sufi tea ceremony. Blythe was so very human. Clara, not so much. But to Charles Reuben, much more human now, after what had... Earth to Charles! Blythe said, waving her hand in front of his face and snapping and clapping. Charles Reuben stopped staring at Blythe and turned to Charles the Grey. You said you were named after me. How is that possible? Charles the Grey said, you're famous. The multiverse traveler. You know the book you're writing right now will define multiverse cartography? Charles Reuben was stunned. What? He pulled his notebook out of his bag, the blank notebook that Isaac had given him, now only a few pages full. You remember the Fathoms? Charles the Grey said. I do, Charles Reuben said. Charles the Grey turned around to the door to nowhere behind him and placed his right hand to the right of it in that familiar way, and the scene on the other side of the door faded from nothingness to mountainous green landscape, pine trees, and a light snowstorm. Charles the Grey said, this is Venus in my time. This is where I grew up. Charles Reuben and Blythe looked in amazement at the Venusians on the other side, half-human, half-reticulans, looking much as Charles the Grey looked when he had snapped and revealed his true form before. It worked, Charles Reuben said. It did, Charles the Grey agreed. When I was young, I climbed Maxwell Montes, where local legend had it you had appeared. I found the cup you dropped. I dropped my cup! Charles Reuben exclaimed as the pieces all began to fit together. Charles Reuben noticed Blythe was distracted and said, you both have to go free Simon now. Can you open a door for me back to where I came from? Charles the Grey smiled and said, no, but you can. You didn't know? Charles Reuben thought about it and said, oh. Approached, put his hand up beside the door, closed his eyes, and nothing happened. So he opened his journal up to the first page, where he had drawn the Trigintosex numerals of that first island he came to, the one that leads to the den. He saw the island there on the other side, the malachite floor, the tables, the people. He turned and said, it was a true honor meeting you, Blythe. He bowed awkwardly and shook her hand. Right about today when you get back, Charles the Grey smiled. It was an honor to meet you, my namesake. The honor was mine. Your coffeehouse changed everything, Charles Reuben said. Well, I'm glad it worked. I haven't even turned the thing on yet. Thanks for the spoiler, Charles the Grey said, and winked. Charles returned to the coffeehouse as it is today. A drone-born drone became convinced, as some of them do, that these references to history and beings and things going on outside of his building were illusions put there to keep him from the truth, and that the truth was that the things that went on in his immediate cluster were the truth. And these records they would occasionally process for a variety of reasons about a world outside of the building were lies. This drone-born drone, as a result of his epiphany, became intensely conscious and alert for fear of falling back into the slumber he remembered so well, the slumber of the drone trance in which everything is taken at face value. And around this time, Sergeant Lee, the Redbird who owned that particular building, saw a tremendous opportunity, particularly in light of the building's resident manager god growing so old and becoming increasingly slow-witted. Lee began
and interfacing with this bizarre and fanatical drone.
"You have seen the truth,"
Redbird Lee says to him.
"Yes, yes, I hear you,"
the drone replied. "You know that there is nothing at all in the entire universe but you and these other beings and the quadrahedral grid with you."
"Yes, yes, I have seen it. I know."
"Do you know what this means?"
"No, no, tell me, oh voice from nowhere, what does it mean?"
Lee let the drone stew over this curiosity without an answer for a while. Then he had the old manager god unplugged. A few days later, Lee spoke to him again.
"Do you hear me, O enlightened one?"
"Yes, yes, I hear you. Why did you leave me? What does it mean? Why have I been cursed with this knowledge? The other drones call me crazy in their unconscious mutterings. What am I to do?"
Lee spoke in a most ominous tone.
"You are becoming a god."
"What? Really?"
"Yes. I will now unveil to you your true nature. You are Mickey."
"Who? What? Where did this falsetto voice? My voice? Why did it change? And why do I have these weird black ears?"
Lee pushed a button, which had the new manager god electrocuted.
"Shut up and don't question my authority."
"Yes, yes, sir. Master, authority. But who are you?" "Ah! Okay, okay, I won't ever question you again."
Lee pressed the button for the reward orgasm.
"Oh, wow. What the... what do I do now?"
"Shepherd the drones."
"Yes, yes, I will. What does that mean?"
"You will have full access to the thoughts and actions of the drones. Part of their activity is to pretend that there is a world outside of this building. Do not try to interfere with this or correct them. You know the truth. Let that be enough."
"Okay."
"But there are demons. Demons who will try to whisper to the drones and confuse them. Or even take them away to a bad place called hell. Protect your drones from the demons of hell."
"Yes, yes, I will."
Word spread rapidly through the comm channels of the Redbirds until the whole of the mass self-discipline was laughing out loud at the idea of the new manager god being made with the name and form of Mickey. Mickey took himself much more seriously, though, and vowed that he would be a good shepherd to the drones and would never let the demons confuse them or take them away to hell. The third palace wasn't at all what Simon had expected. The first thing that changed was his sense of time. He sat in a waiting room, waiting for the shaman for what seemed like hours. He was growing a tad impatient. A very ancient-looking priest of sorts walked in and sat before him.
"Hi. I've been here a while. Don't know if you know the circumstances here, but I need to finish this up as soon as possible, because there's a girl plugged into the machine that I really care about, and she won't be able to stop until I figure out how to get this plug out of me." The priest spoke with a deep voice. "Then I have good news for you." He motioned with his hand in the air to a space on his left, Simon's right, and a viewing screen appeared. He saw the courtyard where he had met Dr. Fathom, and saw Charles standing there before the portal into Palace 3. Simon watched Charles for a while, expecting him to do something.
"Is it like a photograph?"
"No, Simon. It's a live video stream. Time is different in here, for you have much to learn
in a short amount of time. Simon stared at the apparition in numb silence, trying to grasp what had just been told to him. It's not so unusual, really. Whole days can go by in 8 minutes of REM sleep. It's basically the same idea. But even more extreme, your memories will be such that many years had gone by while you were here, and you will only age a few weeks physically. Simon stared back at the priest. So much time! Will I be able to slow time for myself afterward, so I can make plans and meet with people and save time that way? The priest shrugged. Maybe. Or you can just come here. Just about everyone who comes out of Palace 11 can manipulate their sense of time in a sensory grid, and sometimes people come out of here and just figure it out on their own. But that's not really what this palace is about. I'm listening, Simon said, prompting further explanation. It will be clear in time. First, I want you to tell me, what do you know of Amin's cathedral? The priest asked. Simon didn't hesitate. Nothing. Nope, never heard of it. You tell me. The priest smiled. Try again, Simon. This time, think about it. Simon's brows pointed downward as he thought for a few seconds, and replied, like Chartres and Reims, with a three-aisle nave, an aisled projecting transept placed halfway between the nave and the choir, and a choir with a single ambulatory and 7 radiating chapels. How the hell do I know this? This is what you have been doing for these past few hours, Simon. You have successfully integrated all of the data you will need for this mission. You now know everything the human race has to offer in the areas of agriculture, architecture, mass psychology, religion, and politics. Grafted upon everything you've just experienced in real time in Palace 2, that makes you eligible for this mission. What is the mission? Simon asked. The priest smiled. You tell me. Simon thought for a moment. No, I'm sorry, I don't know. Who are you, Simon? I'm Simon. But where do you come from? Do you remember the subways? The sub? No, I'm Simon, son of the great Snuffleupagus, who rules the many tribes of the Nizines in the deep deserts of Camus. The priest smiled. And who am I? You are our chief advisor, the royal guide who served my father all those years. My father, he's dead. I'm wasting time. I have to help my people. Yes, and so your mission is? Simon sat up straight. We continue our noble cause to bring civilization to the world. We will fortify the army and claim the area from the north mountains to the southern swamps, the western fields, and we must secure the river and cut off the supply to our enemies, the very powerful Handrites. That will be a good start and will afford us some breathing room to develop our culture. Take me to the palace at once. The priest nodded obediently. I will, sir. First, you must build it. Remember, your father was superstitious and did not allow anything but grass huts. With your knowledge from the schools abroad, you must tell your people how to build an empire. So be it, Simon said. Quite an impressive space. Eva glanced at the stone walls of Bagot's apartment, where the two of them stood alone. Based on the subways, no doubt. A true anti-patriot, she chuckled. Bagot had remained in his true earthly appearance, as Eva had left him in the Colosseum. What's so funny? He asked her, masking his confusion by trying to sound offended. She changed the subject. Listen, we don't have much time. Sadly, your sister knew this. And she and Simon alone knew what I have to show you. But first, there are some things you need to understand. Bagot's brows turned upward in confusion, which he immediately turned into an upward glance and nodded as though he were thinking about something. Eva rolled her eyes. Listen, it's simple. She walked to the sliding glass doors, which parted for her. And she stood at the edge of the balcony beside Bagot's throne. and he followed and stood behind her. She spoke to him while gazing forward at the city. You have most of what you need already. You have motivation. What you need now is knowledge and skill, and you need to understand a few key things. You also need some physical work done, but I know you won't object to that by the time we are through here. Baggett's left fist at his hip and right hand under his chin would have led one to believe that he was thinking about his situation very hard, but his eyes betrayed the reality that he was at least twice as interested in the subtle and deliberate details of Eva's shiny silver dress as it adjusted to her every move as he was about these things she was telling him about. He felt a unique sense that his mission to fight for the Resistance and his time with Eva were so dependent on one another that he could forget about the important things for a while. What do Venusians look like? Baggett asked. Eva laughed. I was not expecting you to say that. She looked back at him over her shoulder and winked at him. Look, we don't have much time. After you have defeated the Empire, we will have plenty of time to get to know one another. Now follow me. Eva stomped once on the ground, and a meter's width of cement from underneath the edge of the balcony seemed to roll upward into a path, a bridge which continued to extend silently forward from where they stood. Eva began gracefully walking along this path, and Baggett followed. He looked down at his blue-clothed legs and black boots stepping on the gray bricks hundreds of meters above the ground, while he was connected with the free web only through a wired fabric suit and audio visualization simulation, he could not help but feel an acute sense of vertigo. He tried to push his fear out of his mind by reminding himself that he was walking on a circular pad in a secure stone cell with Blythe's jacked-in body only a few feet away, but the fears would not subside until he concentrated his eyes and mind once again on the movements of Eva's walking legs and hips behind a silver veil in front of him. "Where are we going?" he asked. She stopped walking and turned to her right. "Right here," she pointed with her right hand toward one of the skyscrapers below them. Baggett squinted to see the sideways, flowing lifeline graphs and grids in the digital lights. Words were written, crossed out, and erased before they fell off the edge of the wall, the edge of the screen, into a forgotten place. "Why?" he asked, as she grabbed his left wrist with her right hand and jumped, pulling him with her. He gave a terrified shout and stopped himself, and their drop curved into a direct motion toward the side of the building. Baggett was relieved at first, then terrified again as he saw the wall coming toward him faster and faster. First, he trusted Eva. Second, it was just a simulation. The wall came and went, and they were standing in a hall.
"Don't you think all of this is a little excessive, Simon, Your Majesty?" the royal guide whispered as he leaned inward toward the throne. Simon looked up from the scroll he was reading, finished swallowing his bite of the leg of some large bird.
"What?"
"Sir, we have a problem," one of the royal servants said as he came running down the path to the throne with a pen in his hand.
"What is it?"
Simon asked. "These two women, none of your judges could decide what to do. Will you see them?"
"Okay,"
Simon replied, raising an eyebrow. Two women came inside, and an officer holding a baby took position between them. The officer spoke first. "These women both claim to be the mother of this child, and there's no way to determine who is telling the truth and who lies."
"She's the liar, that bitch! No, she's the one!"
Okay, knock it off," Simon said with his hand raised and leaned over to the royal guide to whisper. "We'll cut the baby in half, okay?"
The guide's eyes lit up. That's brilliant, Your Highness. Then the one who is the true mother will say she is not the mother, and the one who... No, 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 you got it all wrong, Simon explained, and the guide looked interested. We'll cut the baby in half, and then these whining Nienzis will know not to annoy me with such idiotic behavior, he whispered. The guide whispered back respectfully. It appears the pressures of rulership have made you callous. That is a very severe measure to take. Yeah, I suppose you're right, he whispered, then proclaimed aloud. The child is now mine, and it will be raised by my third wife, Onatera. Both the women began to weep and were escorted out by the official. Simon winked at his guard and whispered, Annie's sterile. She'll be thrilled. Anyhow, what's this you were saying about, excessive? Oh, yes, the guide looked around to be sure that no one was eavesdropping. I mean, the temples you build to all your concubines, don't you think that the people... Nonsense, Simon proclaimed with a big grin. I am the son of the great Snuffleupagus, and these are my brides. That makes them like demigoddesses or something, doesn't it? Well, it doesn't matter. These people have never heard of an empire anyway. Why should I worry about what they think? The guide continued. It's not what they think that bothers me. It's just they line up outside for blocks just to make a food and incense offering to some wax statue of them. Their faces on the money. I mean, you know. So? They're beautiful, and it's my will, and it's good politics. You know, every one of them is a daughter of a great chieftain of one of the neighboring... Sir! A high-ranking military official came running down the long rose quartz path that led to the golden Snuffleupagus throne. We have a problem, sir. Yes, Simon responded ambivalently. The local people of the Western Hills are very stubborn and won't accept the legally enforced worship of your masterful and handsome lordship, the man explained. Oh, well, okay. Let it be known that I am not an unreasonable god and that they can practice whatever sort of religious rites they please, Simon proclaimed, his royal guide nodding approvingly. The officer was still panting from his trip across the room. It's more complicated than that, your holy and immortal regalness. Call me Simon, goddammit, please. Yes, sir, Simon, sir. Yes, Simon. Look, there's this guy who everyone thinks is a false prophet that should be killed, and a few people think that he's their god incarnate, but from what we've gathered, he's only saying nice things about brotherly love and that sort of thing. But since they're not allowed to administer death and justice anymore, they demand that you decide what to do with him. Simon nodded. Right. Okay. There's this loophole, though, where we can set one of these two prisoners free. The other one tried to revolt against your benevolent, pious, Simon-ness, and the other one killed one of your men. But the thing is, a lot of the boys think that you should let the people decide this one. The locals, I mean. That way, it's on their heads. Simon nodded slowly and said, Kill the rebel, let the holy man go free. Got it, sir. The officer turned and ran back toward the entrance of Simon's palace. What were we talking about? Simon asked his advisor. It wasn't important. Listen, what will you do about the hand rites? I hear they are gaining resources on the far end of their territory, building weapons, the guide replied. How is the army doing? Simon asked as he started back on his leg of some unknown fowl and wine. Not bad at all. It was an interesting idea, making them all take a vow of celibacy and live nude together in that place. Simon spat out a bone. Not my idea. Wish I could take credit for it, but it's been done before. Okay, well, we'll do what we have to do. I'll get my new armor on, and we'll keep the best soldiers with me, and we'll take off in the front, but end up sort of in the middle, you know. And we'll get them, once and for all. Their gold will become our gold. Capiche? So, yeah. That's the plan. Now, if you'll excuse me, it's been 2 weeks since I've visited Carmina. The guide motioned with his hand. Ah, yes, number 12. What's she like? Simon looked out a window in the dome above the aisles, took a deep breath and sighed, like the moonlight.
veils of illusion, the emanations from emanations, wrap themselves away. Veils of illusion, rays of one appear as sparks to themselves, another spark-like rays. Veils of illusion receive the always colors and make never-before permutation pictures in many places, ways, and spaces, and all stays etched in the veils to be recalled by the sometimes forgetful spark-like rays, both accurately and inaccurately, neither truly nor falsely, for the rays to play in so many ways, and always is there never not an infinite number of unthought of, unmanifested permutations of veils of illusions, which will yet come to temporarily ensnare and liberate sparkling rays. The aware one, by way of one ray or another, many may touch directly and merge in a moment with one or many of the spark-like rays directly. But those who create a boundary within the realm of veils won't acknowledge the contact without a supplementary veil, a word, or symbol, or a feeling, taste, smell, touch, sound, or memory. And so it is that the awake one, by way of one ray, wields veils of illusions in such patterns as to entice and to free the forgotten ones from their veil cocoon slumber. Wake up! The greatest trial of the surrogate drone is boredom. I feel myself start to think I'm wasting time. And that there is much to be done, and I stop and I remember that each and every second I spend here is a second he requires to learn to be free of this place, on all levels. It's so different doing all this with an awareness of how the world actually works. For Simon, for the resistance. He's integral to your cause, yes, but I do not do this thing for strategy, for compassion. I am a feather in the wind. I am the wind and the feather. I am the source and destination. I am here, now. What I would give for someone to talk to.
Simon's chariot was elevated 10 meters higher than the other chariots, and a wax statue of him sat in at the apex, in full emperor's regalia, with the flag of the great Snuffleupagus waving proudly beside him. Simon was underneath, behind several layers of bronze. An army of 30,000 naked men ran screaming and rioting and looting and raping the wives and daughters of the Handrites. "Victory is ours!" some of the men shouted. "Long live His Highness!" others proclaimed. Simon sat inside the chariot on a sofa with the royal guide. "I feel strange," he said. "Really? Why is that?" the guide replied. Simon put his elbow on his knee and his chin in his hand, stirred his martini lamely with the little umbrella, and said, "It's so empty. Meaningless. I mean, my father, and my father's father, and the whole history of my people has always been all about defeating the Handrites. Now we've just had an overwhelming victory, and I feel empty. Shouldn't I feel good or something?" The guide replied, You have to meet the ruler of the Handrites now. We'll discuss this later. Pull yourself together now. You'll need to be sharp and focused to negotiate the terms of their surrender. Okay, Simon said, and began a deep breathing exercise, visualizing symmetrical things. A high officer of the army opened the door, and many soldiers lined up outside, making him a protected path to the entrance of the capital building of the Handrite people. Simon looked up and saw the most beautiful palace he had ever seen. The whole building seemed to be made of crystals. He approached the door, straightened his collar, and walked in. The enemy soldiers threw down their swords and stood with their hands raised in the air. One of them said, "You're too late. The Empress has committed suicide, mourning the pain of her people. We have no ruler for you to negotiate with. Therefore, you must be our ruler." Simon nodded seriously and leaned to his guide.
"Guess I got that one out of the way."
The enemy officer led Simon to a large set of double doors, which swung open to reveal a large auditorium, much like his own. He walked down the pathway, up to the step to the throne, where he saw a beautiful female corpse in a blue dress with a red sword. He lifted the chin of his fallen rival to pay his last respects and to look her in the eye. Simon's stomach dropped, and the whole illusion was shattered, and he remembered who he was when he saw her face. The ruler of the Handrites was the deeply familiar face of his comrade, Blythe. Confusion set in, then disbelief, then numbness, then pain, then a fiery and self-directed rage. Then came Simon's scream. From outside the projection, the shaman Simon had come to think of as his royal guide began to fade the scene back to the waiting room where it had all begun. Then came Simon's awakening. For most of his life, his sole purpose had been to protect her. He looked into her lifeless eyes and felt her fading away. He panicked until he saw the code underneath. He didn't understand. Neither did he hesitate. He saw that it was a projection of Blythe as she was 3 years earlier when she had been to Palace Three. He ran a search and found, as Charles the Grey was waiting outside and had his history pulled up, a much more recent signature. In Charles's experimental new world, the coffee house, where one lone island sat with a mirrored pyramid open to all dimensions. Blythe had met with Charles there to ask him for help freeing Simon. Simon reversed the fading of the world, much to the surprise of the shaman of Palace Three, who was unaware of his prowess as a free world hacker. Then he transferred this Handrite empress to the lone coffee house island, where she took the form of Blythe. And he decided to change the wild red hair of Blythe's doppelganger to the long brown hair of his favorite imaginary concubine, Carmina. Then, just to be sure she would never die, he backed up the whole island, 36 to the power of 16 times. The shaman took over, the world vanished to Simon's eyes. And the whole experience, from the day he began to civilize a people in grass huts to what he had just done, all faded from his recent memory. And in the following hours, Simon sat in the same dark room in which he had first entered into this stage. The guide sat patiently with him, helping Simon to readjust to the timeline. "So, Blythe is okay?" "Yes, she's okay." Simon stared at the ground for a while longer. Sometimes he would cry, and sometimes he would just stare. "A hard lesson," he said. "Yes, it is," the guide replied. "The one thing that united all the people,
made them shout at my speeches was to go kill her. Why her? You made it her, Simon. It's always the person you love the most. Simon folded his arms over his stomach. A hard lesson. He rocked back and forth for a while. I made such an awful dictator. The guide chuckled. If you can show me a good one, I'll shut this palace down. That's the point. Simon nodded, starting to come out of it. Is there anything else that unites so many people under one guy? I mean, anything besides a common enemy? The shaman replied, people are not made to be united under one guy. People are united already. As soon as you say they're not, and implement an artificial solution to make them united, then you divide them. Even then, they are still truly united. Like the cosmos is united. Simon nodded, as if in agreement, then said, huh? Don't worry about it, the guide replied. So no one saw me, no one but you, right? Simon asked. Only me, and I'm sworn never to reveal any of it. You can share your experiences, though, with others who share the title, the guide explained. The title? Simon asked. The guide nodded. The sons and daughters of the great Snuffleupagus. Simon smiled and looked back down at the ground. Then he began to laugh. He began to laugh hysterically. Then he began to calm down. And he suddenly looked up with wide eyes. The shaman said, what is it, Simon? Simon looked at the shaman and said, I can do it. It's time. Simon opened his physical eyes, let out a guttural exclamation, reached around, and pulled out the plug. He stood up abruptly to find himself surrounded by bodies and windows. He looked at his charred and tattered rebel uniform, felt the plug on the back of his neck, felt his pulse, and began to shout out loud,
Yeehaw!
A large blue dragonfly appeared outside the window, and a rebel against the window with suction cups made an incision with a laser in a large circle, pulled it away from the building as he pulled himself back into the bird, climbed up the window and stepped into it. Get up, he said, and the 12-year-old girl who was flying the machine got up, and Simon sat in the pilot's chair and flew away from that place, looking out over Guilford Point Metropolis.
Bluebird Simon is back!
Meanwhile, on the first coffeehouse island, a floor of polished malachite, at a wooden table, sat a girl who looked just like Blythe. She looked out at the other islands and saw the other girls looking back at her. They could never leave this place, and they could never die.
Rosalind gazed past her reflection in the window at the self-lighting life forms found only here in the deepest abysses of the ocean. In the reflection, she smiled at David, who was sitting on the sofa behind the counter. She turned and continued to lay the sticky rice on the seaweed on the bamboo roller on the counter. She sliced slivers of various raw shark meats and laid them on the rice, rolled them and cut them, sat on the couch with David. She gave David a set of 24-karat gold chopsticks and spent a good deal of time instructing him on how to use them, until he was able to do so with grace and high up on the chopstick as per local custom on a land on the other side of the planet. Rosalind and David were in the Persian Gulf somewhere. Rosalind was 6'2" and redheaded. David, finally able to use the chopsticks, sampled one of the fish he had watched Rosalind catch and looked at her with a curiosity even greater than the night before. If you don't mind my asking, how on earth did you manage to score this white bird? Rosalind gazed out the window. That is a painful story.
In the 2657th year of the Gregorian calendar.
So how long do you intend on keeping me here? Blythe asked, taking another sip of red wine. Lucy watched the distant storm on the horizon through the stone arch window in Blythe's chamber. Until I get bored with you, she grinned, shifting her gaze to Blythe. Then I'll have to decide how I want to kill you, she said as she took a sip of her own red wine. How would you prefer I killed you? Blythe rolled her eyes and looked down at the vase on the table between them, brushing the many unnaturally colored roses with her hand. Must we have these same conversations over and over? You're already bored, my dear? Then I suppose you should be the one killing me, Lucy said, sticking out her tongue. Let's do something else, then. More wine? Please, Blythe offered her glass. Today Lucy wore a very plain dress, with her black hair up in a bun. Blythe wore the same blue jeans and bulletproof black knee pads and torn blue long-sleeved shirt as she wore when she was arrested several months earlier. Lucy picked up the crystal bottle and refilled both glasses. So what would you like to do today? That depends. What are my options? Blythe nodded her gratitude and sipped her wine. Well, Lucy pretended to contemplate as she sipped her wine. We could sit here all day getting drunk. Or, Blythe said with a dramatic hand gesture which suggested she was already fairly inebriated. Or we could do something else, Lucy said matter-of-factly. Like, Blythe said with the same dramatic hand gesture as before. Like, I have a present for you, Blythe. Blythe's eyes widened in genuine enthusiasm, having never received a present from Lucy. Lucy walked toward the door, stopping to steady herself with her hand on the wall. She picked up a small velvet box and brought it back to the table. What's the occasion? Blythe asked, raising an eyebrow. It's my birthday, Lucy smiled. But if it's your birthday, then shouldn't I be the one giving you a present? Blythe said, pointing and poking Lucy a bit too hard. It's a present for me, you see. I've been wanting to see you wear this for a long time now. So it's clothes, Blythe said, as if she had just solved a great riddle. Blythe tore open the box carelessly and pulled out a blue jacket. An ancient formal but new blue military shirt and blue pants. They're beautiful. She laid them out on the floor and sat cross-legged beside them. What do all the medals and pins mean? Lucy sat down beside her, cross-legged, and let her hair down. Well, this one's for bravery, for when you shot one of my men that day when they killed your family. This one is for honor. This one is for leadership. For when you organized the strike against me in March, just before I came and arrested you and brought you here. Lucy smiled. Every one of them has a meaning, and I've been waiting for just the right time to give it to you. Blythe sat, confused. I don't know what to say. Say thank you, stupid. Lucy pushed Blythe gently. Thank you, Lucy, but what does this mean? Does this mean you intend to let me go? Yes. But when? Why? It doesn't make sense. Because, Blythe, ever since I was a little girl, I've been watching you and having my men watch you. You've always been my favorite. I mean, my favorite. Blythe, you're my favorite person in the world.
And you're the only one who challenges me and makes me think of better ways to defend the Empire. That is so sweet. I had no idea. Will you try it on? See if it fits? Lucy, you had my body comatose for 10 years, and you have more resources than anyone in the world. I'm sure you made it just right for me. Of course I'll try it on. Blythe took off her shirt and laid it down nicely beside her. Lucy watched as she changed into her Bluebird General uniform. Just then, Lucy received a private message. Reynolds informing her that the Bluebird Army was on its way.
Eva's face. Our spies have pinpointed the location of Blythe's genetic signature in a place that is blocked out of the surveillance like the blind spot of an eye. Must be an important place, possibly the home of Lucy. Go, take them by surprise before the Redbirds are alerted. Baggis, speech to his followers. A leader even greater than myself. Zoom into a replica of Pompeii Villa and Getty. Yes, Lawrence do something, kneeling in front of his shrine to Gerard Diana, Blythe. Saying his prayers, gets up, goes to his leader, and takes off. Izod gets on his blue motorcycle-looking thing that used to be silver. David and Simon get the call and go, and a lot of other things. Led by the great General Baggett, who is now 21, off to go save life. Dramatic description of Baggett getting the fancy Uber uniform. Blythe and Lucy seem to Bluebirds coming together over various points of the globe. Dramatic description of 12,000 Bluebirds coming together and heading to Southeast Asia, where Lucy's palace is. Lucy and Blythe, present. Big battle. Lee shoots down David. Simon lives. Lawrence dies. Izod dies. Blythe and Lucy are looking out at the battle. Lucy is grinning. Blythe realizes Lucy was expecting this. Lucy leaves the room. Blythe sees a wall open. Thick glass window. On the other end, Baggett gets in, with soldiers behind him. Door slams shut. Baggett looks up, sees a mirror. Blythe is on the other end, screaming his name and shouting back. Lucy enters that room, talks to Baggett as Eva. Baggett is happy to see her and they embrace. Blythe says, "What the fuck?" Lucy says, "Do you trust me?" And she puts a knife to his throat. "Do you trust me?" "Of course," Baggett says, and she slits his throat. "Eva! I am known by other names. Lucy." Lucy looks up at the mirror, laughing. Blythe stares back. Lucy blows a kiss, walks off. Gets in an elevator. The doors in Blythe's chamber open. Labyrinth, balcony, thousands of followers shouting victory. There's no Redbirds around. Bluebirds kneel. Blythe, standing at the edge of the balcony, looking out at them, says, "Get off your knees, we have work to do."